Hello and welcome to 10x9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 300th 10x9 podcast. What a landmark moment for 10x9. The podcast has gone through many changes since it began in 2017, mainly improvements, I hope. But one thing hasn't changed, and that is the quality of the true stories. To mark this 300th edition, I've gone diving deep into the murky archives to find stories you will not have heard before, even if some of the voices are familiar. And I'll be featuring these in our next few episodes. Today, there are 3 brilliant stories from 8 years ago.
However, I eventually turned out to be a happy homosexual. In 1988, I came north to Belfast, that well-known city of gay liberation.
I might have been the youngest person ever in primary school to gain a cycling proficiency award and a Burns Federation poetry reciting certificate, but nobody ever knew that.
Are we your family, Dad? She asked. Yes, he replied. And do you have other families, Dad? No, said my very conservative Catholic father.
Okay then, let's start with our first story on this special podcast. Remember, these are from our earliest recording efforts, so they might not be as crystal clear as we're used to, but they sounded pretty okay to me. So, let's go back to July 2017, to Belfast Black Box, our home venue. The theme was OMG, and we were part of the Pride Festival. Now, you should know this voice well, because it's Richard O'Leary.
I remember the day my mother asked me, Richard, would you like to go on pilgrimage? Pilgrimage made me think of travel far away, some exotic place. I was a young Irish teenager and had never been outside Ireland. Maybe my mum was going to take me to Lourdes. Lourdes was a sunny pilgrimage site in the south of France. Lourdes was where Mary, the mother of Jesus, Our Lady, had appeared to a French teenager. Thousands of people went to Lourdes to seek cures, to ask Mary to make things better, and for the sunshine. Mum handed me an invitation card. This card, it was from our local church. It reads, St. Francis, Cork, Sunday, July the 23rd, 1978, pilgrimage to Knock. Knock wasn't in France. It was in the west of Ireland. 100 years earlier, Mary had appeared in Knock. However, it was so wet that night that there was some doubt whether the apparition had really happened. Nevertheless, it became Ireland's most famous place of pilgrimage. The village of Knock was in bog country. Sunny and exotic like Lourdes, it was not. But I looked again at the card and read the words of the invitation. Our Lady, Mother of the Universe, Mother of Ireland. In the Catholic religion of my childhood, I conflated Our Lady with my own mother. This was an invitation I could not refuse. I replied to my mother, of course, Mum, I'll go with you on pilgrimage to Knock. Mum and I were very close. I really liked the idea of going away, just Mum and me. When we arrived at Knock, it was, as I expected, wet. The village itself was small, but the church at Knock was huge. The church is called the Basilica of Our Lady, Queen of Ireland. Mum and I approached the basilica and went inside. We were handed a leaflet. It says, to Our Lady of Knock, perpetual novena. A novena is a special prayer, a prayer when you really want something. The novena prayer says, ask and you shall receive. Our Lady of Knock, Queen of Ireland, you gave hope to your people in a time of distress. People in distress, that was me. Because I carried with me a secret, which I had not even shared with my mum. A secret about which I was desperate to receive a cure. So I kept the novena leaflet. Mum stepped into the pew, and I followed her. We both knelt down. I brought my palms together, and I said a prayer. Our Lady of Knock, I beg you, please don't let me be gay. My mum, she'd be terribly upset. And she may stop loving me. And I'd have to leave home. Amen. After Mass in the Basilica, Mum took me to a restaurant and bought me high tea. High tea in Knock was delicious. A bit like an Ulster fry with lots of added cream cake. Catholics usually eat well on pilgrimage. Then Mum and I wandered around the main street where there were stalls selling souvenirs. Mum bought a small, clear, plastic statue bottle in the shape of Our Lady. We filled it with holy water in the Basilica and we brought it back home to Cork. Well, my prayer to Our Lady of Knock, Queen of Ireland, it didn't work. Our Lady didn't cure me of being gay. 4 years later, in 1982, when I turned 18, I moved out of the family home and I left Cork forever. However, I eventually turned out to be a happy homosexual. In 1988, I came north to Belfast, that well-known city of gay liberation. There I met Mervyn, my loving life partner. I even gradually regained the faith. But I didn't return to Knock. Or at least I didn't return to Knock for 37 years. That was in 2015. 2015 was the year of the referendum in the Republic of Ireland to extend civil marriage to same-sex couples. I set up a new campaign group called Faith in Marriage Equality. I heard the call, "Go west, young man." Or in my case, "Go west, middle-aged man." And I went to campaign in the west of Ireland. I called this part of my campaign, My Pilgrimage for Yes. When I posted on Facebook, my itinerary, someone commented, "Oh my God, you're intending to campaign for marriage equality in Knock. They'll eat you alive. You do know Knock's the conservative Catholic heartland of Ireland." I replied calmly and firmly and said that there shouldn't be any no-go areas for campaigning for marriage equality. I arrived in Knock on the 3rd of May 2015. It was a Sunday morning. I began the day by popping in to a cafe for a hot breakfast. Being back in Knock after 37 years made me think of my previous visit there with Mum. Mum had died a decade earlier, and I still feel sadness about not having been able to share with my mum about me being gay. After breakfast, I met up with a local campaigner from Yes Equality Mayo. We first headed for the smaller parish church. Inside the church, I noticed a stack of colourful leaflets. These leaflets. They are novena prayers, and they say, "Prayer for Ireland. We ask all to pray the Divine Mercy Novena from May the 14th to May the 22nd, Voting Day." This novena was a prayer for a no vote against marriage equality. Leaving the parish church, I walked slowly down the main street. It's a long, straight street. I was feeling wary. Wary like Doc Holliday in the movie Gunfight at the OK Corral. All I was armed with was a handful of my own campaign leaflets with my message of love and equality. We approached the Basilica of Our Lady of Knock, and I pushed through the swing doors. Inside, a priest was saying Mass. I stepped into a pew, and I went down on my knees, and I said a prayer. A quiet, private prayer. Outside the Basilica, we took up our position in the square. I was clutching the bundle of my leaflets. As people emerged in the Basilica, I handed them my leaflet. Good morning, here's something to read on the marriage referendum. My leaflet reads, a letter to the pilgrims at Knock. Today is the third day of my pilgrimage from Donegal to Cork. Sometimes in life, we have to take a step into unfamiliar territory. I feel apprehensive about sharing my personal story, especially among people of faith. I was fortunate to experience a loving, committed, faithful relationship with my partner Mervyn for 25 years. People accepted my leaflet and I handed out dozens. Suddenly, a man appeared in front of me. The man's face was very red, bursting with fury, and he said, "You're promoting sodomy. This is against the church teaching." I replied that two of the Church of Ireland bishops had come out in support of marriage equality. He responded, "They're heretics." Then the man turned and ran wildly after the people who had already accepted my leaflets. He snatched my leaflets from their hands. My fellow campaigner heard his shouting and recognized that I was under fire. She hovered over and managed to draw the man away. I continued my pilgrimage for Yes in other towns in the west of Ireland. As voting day approached, I realized that the novena for a no vote was reaching its culmination. In response, I arranged for our own campaign group to hold our own public event, a faith witness for Yes. This became known as the Yes Vina. Would our Yes Vina for equality be heard? Or would it be the No Vina that would triumph? On the 22nd of May, the large majority of the Irish electorate voted yes to marriage equality. I felt that my own private prayer at Knock had also been answered.
Thanks so much, Richard. You've not changed a bit. And your story is as fresh today as it was then. Thank you for being such a supporter of 10x9 over the years. Even if we're wallowing in nostalgia just now, 10x9 still goes on and is always looking for new storytellers. If you're wondering what the process is for telling your story, it's quite simple. Check out the themes and dates on the website and send your story through the submissions page. I'll give you feedback and help you make it the best it can be. Alternatively, you can email directly at 10by9belfast@gmail.com. Okay, on to our next story, and her wonderful soft Scottish accent has charmed 10by9 audiences for years. Here's a story from April 2017, when the theme was young. Here's Helen Killick.
My first day of school was so disappointing that I decided to make my own way home at break time. I just walked out of the school gates while my fellow scholars were stooring round, as we called it. I didn't feel like I was doing anything naughty. School just wasn't what I expected, and it didn't occur to me that anyone might object if I gave it a miss. Finding my way home at 5 years old wasn't as hard as you might think. Our Perthshire village had one long main street, with the church, the shop, and the school at one end, and the park at the other end, and my house was at the park end. In my preschool years, I had been up and down that road hundreds of times, usually with my mother, going to the shop for messages, or on Sundays with the whole family walking the length of the street to church with Sunday shoes on, my dad swinging a rolled up umbrella like a walking stick. There were no street numbers on the houses on my street, only names. House names presumably chosen by the first inhabitants. Of course, you could expect to find the humorous name, Dun Roman, and the more edgy, Dun Robin. The functionary coach house, the horticultural Lilac Cottage, the historic Wallace Cottage, where William Wallace had supposedly once stopped for a drink. The geographically incongruous Rathfryland, why, I don't know. And the nostalgic names like Dalsheen, Glomach, and ours, Delvin, reminding inhabitants of happy family memories. These names all appeared on garden gates and above front doors, mapping my journey between our end of the street and the other end. So at 5 years old, I knew all the names. I recognised them when I saw them. I'm sure my teacher parents had encouraged me in my early attempts to translate the shapes of the letters into words on our walks up and down the village street, because for them every day was a school day. So I imagine they had a part to play, but my mother believes that the village street had taught me to read. I think I should point out at this stage that I wasn't a child genius, I was just a little bit odd. So when my first proper school day came, I was more than ready for it. I arrived in P1 with Mrs. Bruce, who welcomed me with a big smile. I could see racks of books at the side of the classroom and trays of coloured blocks, crayons and paints on the shelves at the back. There were two big round tables with 8 or 9 children sitting at each. And I was given a place to sit at a table beside a girl called Martha. I hadn't met her before, which surprised me because I thought I knew every other child in the village. We hadn't been there very long when Mrs. Bruce told us to go and play in the sand tray. The sand was moist and had that peculiar, pungent 1970s primary school sand smell that lingered on your hands. I did my best to find something interesting to do with the small plastic shapes and cups, but I have to admit, I was a bit disappointed with school so far. The classroom seemed to hold such promise, and Martha was very friendly, but pushing smelly wet sand around wasn't my idea of education. So just before break time then, the tray of milk bottles arrived. Small glass bottles of milk with straws poking through the shiny tops. On my first day, they looked quite tempting. But anyone else who's been, I presume it was the same here in Scotland, anyone else at primary school in the 70s will know that there was nothing inside those bottles that could be described as appealing. Younger listeners need to know that there was some kind of dark art practiced by 1970s teachers, which enabled them to leave a tray of milk bottles in exactly the right place for the right length of time to produce the right conditions for primary school milk. Not cold, not hot, not fresh, not completely off, just somewhere horribly in between. And Mrs. Bruce demanded cheerily that we drink up our milk. So I complied, and my disappointment with school went up another level. Then we were released into the playground for the Stoorerund, but I was ready for home. So out the gates I went into the street. Langdale, Hawthorne Cottage, Huntley Croft, my litany of house names began as I walked down towards home. St. Colm's, Longcroft, Norwood. I was making good progress, but then I saw a familiar figure in the distance coming towards me. It was my mother, who had chosen that moment for her walk to the shops. Shop. I was glad to see her, and she seemed surprised and not so happy to see me. I don't remember exactly what she said, but she turned me around and walked me straight back to school, just as my class was lining up to go back inside. Nobody knew about my absconding. I had skipped a whole 30 minutes of school and nobody seemed to notice. So back inside the classroom, it was reading time. We went up and turned to Mrs. Bruce's desk so she could select the right starting point for us. And after trying out a few things, she gave me my first reading book. I skipped through the pages and she gave me another one. And I noticed I had a different book from Martha and everybody else at my table. And then it happened. Quietly, without fuss, as if it was the most natural thing in the world, Mrs. Bruce said, "Why don't you sit at the other table? Everyone else there is reading the same book as you." So I complied and dragged my tiny P1 chair across the room to the other table. And I sat at the other table in Mrs. Bruce's room for the rest of that year, no longer beside Martha, but beside my new companion, Frieda Williams. At the end of the year, Mrs. Bruce said that all of us at our table would be moving to Mrs. Potts's room when we came back after the summer holidays, as we were all going up into P3. P3. I'd been sitting at the P2 table, and now I was going into P3. I'd skipped a whole year of school, and nobody seemed to notice. And so it began. The simple move from one table to the other had destined me to being perpetually too young. I don't know when the other teachers realised I was too young, if at all. My parents worked it out for themselves at some point in my P3 year. But at that stage, it didn't seem to matter too much, and it was too late to do anything about it, so nothing was ever said. It did matter later, though. I was too young to hear my P5 teacher say, "So you'll all know by now there's no Father Christmas." I was 8. I was too young when the P6 bully saw anything that made anyone different a good reason for her attention. I was too young for the move from a small village school to an urban comprehensive of 1,800 pupils. I'd just turned 10. And I was too young to understand the two divining questions of teenage years, never mind understand the etiquette around the required answers. Are you Protestant or Catholic? Yes, even in Dundee. And are you a virgin? I was 11 when I was first asked that one. And some activities at school were denied me. I was too young to join in the European school exchange programmes or start the Duke of Edinburgh scheme with the rest of my class. But I might have been the youngest person ever in primary school to gain a cycling proficiency award and a Burns Federation poetry reciting certificate. But nobody ever knew that. I think I was too young for university. I was offered a place when I was 16 and I just turned 17 when I left home. My parents panicked a bit when I didn't get a place at the Hall of Residence and drove to Aberdeen to advocate on my young behalf at the admin office. They didn't succeed, but they were persistent, so a lady who worked in the office took pity on me and gave me lodgings for my first year. After graduation, I began to feel a little more like everyone else. I now work in a school looking out for the young vulnerable ones and maybe giving them a little bit of the support I could have done with myself. But sometimes I still feel too young. I feel too young to have children that will soon be finished school, having done the full 14 years. I'm too young to have lost a parent. Too young to see my friends retiring. I've carried the feeling all my life that maybe I'll be found out one day. And I guess today's the day. But school children have a habit of bringing you face to face with reality. From time to time, a pupil puts their hand up and calls me mummy by mistake. I take quiet delight in those moments, especially if it comes from one of the hard lads. I catch a glimpse of the child that's still there beneath the bravado of adolescence. That was until recently, when I got my first granny. After a lifetime of feeling too young, I'm just starting to feel a bit too old. I seem to have skipped 30 years and I didn't even notice.
Helen, what a pleasure to hear that again. Thank you. Let's have you back at the 10x9 mic soon, please. Just a quick thank you very much to all of you who have donated to 10x9 via Patreon and at our live events over the years. It really helps to keep this project going. It pays for the website, recording devices, etc. And we really are so grateful. For those of you wondering, 10x9 has always been free. But unlike other free things such as social media, etc., there really are no catches. Just enjoy. Okay, on to our third and final story on this special podcast. It was recorded at Corrymeela in April 2017, and the theme was frenemies. Here's my introduction. It's the man who helped create 10x9, who's the other half of 10x9, from Cork, Padraig O'Toole.
In Irish, there isn't a verb for love. You can say, I have love for. You can even say, I am in love with. But you can't say, I love. There isn't a way to say that. When I was younger, I was always struck embarrassed by television scenes in which families engaged in some kind of I love you exchange. I remember once watching Different Strokes, where one of the kids had been angry at their parent and there was a trauma and a crisis and the threat that the world and all its adopted parents would crash. And then at the end, everything was solved by the assertion from the dad to his son of, son, you know I love you. I remember talking to Cahill, my now dead best friend, about that episode. It was proof why we were best friends, because he understood exactly. We both made puking noises at that moment and talked about how horrible it was to be in the presence of your parents when some stupid television show showed families telling each other that they loved each other. You can't say I love you in Irish. It goes deeper than that. In the Ireland I grew up in, you don't say I love you, in English even. When I was dragging myself through my early teens, I remember my little sister once at Saturday morning breakfast asking my dad questions. Are we your family, Dad? She asked. Yes, he replied. And do you have other families, Dad? No, said my very conservative Catholic father. And do you love us, Dad? Deep staring at coagulating Weetabix was followed by a muttered, yeah. My sister must have been watching some stupid program where the actors spoke a language where you could say, I love you. And do you love Anya? Anya's my older sister. Dad was getting into a stride now, sounding a bit American, and said, yeah. My little sister started going through the names of all the children in our family, checking whether Dad's love extended equally. I'm not joking when I tell you that I got up and left before she got to me. I didn't want to hear it. There can be a peculiarity in the openness of our confessions of truth to each other. When I was 16, I was helping on some church camp. It was mostly Church of Ireland children with Irish accents tinged with the Queen's English who used shall more than I ever did. These were Northern Protestants with clear voices and driving licenses who spoke about certainty and politics and the mainland. I was sure that in whatever language they spoke up north that there might have been verbs for love. There was a girl, Lisa, who was a year older than me. We got talking, and somehow, I don't know why, but I told her that nobody had ever told me that they loved me. I'm now 41. It was 24 years ago that I told her that. And like I'd have said to her, I've never been on a plane, or I don't know how to drive, or I can speak Irish. I said it with such ease. She looked at me as if I'd said to her that I'd never slept in a bed. The next day, when I got out of my bed at this summer camp, there was a note stuck to my sleeping bag. Now, I don't actually know how she got into the boys' dorm to affix. Not such an innocent Northern Protestant. Anyway. But there was a note stuck to my sleeping bag. And it said, I can't believe nobody has ever told you that they love you. And it said, I want to tell you that I love you. Part of me brushed it off. Northern prods, I thought. They do things differently up there. But I kept the note. I kept it inside a book I loved. And I don't know how many times I read the note. I lost count, really. Certainly enough to turn the clean, crisp note paper into something more resembling fabric. Something to get warmth from. Something to love. Something to sleep under. My first time meeting Protestants from the North had been at a church camp in August 1987. I spent my camp asking the poor Protestants if they were Irish or English, with a curiosity I usually reserved for asking whether certain characters in Wonder Woman were goodies or baddies. At the end of the church camp, which is another story, one of the Protestant women, a woman with blonde hair named Annette, said, "Give me a hug." I didn't know what she meant. I didn't know what hugs were to give her one, and I didn't know that I had one to give. And suddenly I found my own body being wrapped and folded and sheltered and held in place by somebody else's arms. And my arms were around her body. And for the first time ever, I thought, this is what arms are for. I still don't know what the best verb to use with hugging is. Do we give them? Do we have them? Do we get them? Up until I was 18, I could count the amount of times I'd been hugged. At that stage, it was 20. I knew who each one had come from, where it had happened, and how it had felt. There were long hugs, quick hugs, awkward ones, ones where my face was smushed into a shoulder, ones where I felt like I was falling into myself. And does the counting of hugs count as one sadness or many? For me, it was a way to keep consolation close when consolation was far. It was a survival, a way to mark the seasons, not by weather, but by embracings. At any point, I could tell you how many months it had been since I was hugged. This is not an invitation for hugging afterwards. I just need to make that really clear. I'm all about the hugs now. I've lost count. I just need to make that clear. Whatever verb should be used, when I was younger, it was clear for me who was the subject of the sentence. I was the one who needed to be hugged. My dad is incapable of hugging people. You might think he's about to give a good old proper full frontal hug, but at the last minute he executes a rugby pass turn and you end up patting his shoulder while he half reaches for your hand and you end up kind of kissing his earlobe, and the whole thing looks as awkward and poorly constructed as this sentence is. He's a fierce man for giving a pretty woman a kiss on the cheek though, a lovely, kind and happy gesture, but he's crap at hugging. I used to go fishing with Dad every now and then. Once he was on the side of a rocky outcrop fishing for mackerel that I would never taste because I hated mackerel. I was exercising that peculiar art that teenagers do by being the enemy of their parents, staring at the back of him while he was fishing. I was thinking superior thoughts, judging him, knowing that whatever I'd be, I'd never be like him. There he was, a few feet in front of me. I could see his old trousers, his woolen jumper, the runners he always wore when he went fishing. I could see his bald head, the wispy white hairs covering a sunburned scalp, and I was trying to nurture in me that art of hatred for everything that he was and everything I would never be. But it was like I was taken over by something. I could feel a burning in my stomach, a swelling in my chest. I felt like I needed to yell, but I didn't know what I wanted to yell. And I didn't yell, but in my mind, I said it over and over and over. I love him. I love him. I love him. I love him. This was nothing like Different Strokes. I couldn't even say you. I had to say him. And there was no hug, and it wasn't even out loud. And it came with anger. Anger at him for never saying it. Anger at myself for never feeling it. Fear that there was a part of me that needed to be loved, that needed to love, that needed to say it, and wanted to love him. The world felt big and scary, and I felt small, and all my sculptures of teenage hate and enmity and contempt were gone, and I was 16 on a rock on the cliffy edge of Cork, and there was a vast sea in front of us, and I was afraid. Is this a love story? I don't know. Maybe it's more of a lament. He's still crap at hugging, and there isn't a verb in Irish for love. But since my dad has a mobile phone, he always signs it, Love Dad. It's a joke amongst the six kids. He's incapable of sending a text without signing it, Love Dad. For instance, Mammy and me are in B&Q looking for the pansies, Love Dad. You haven't phoned us in 3 weeks, Love Dad. Mammy wants to know if you can bring down cheap paracetamol the next time you're coming to Cork. It's cheaper in the north than it is in the south. Love, Dad. You haven't phoned us in 5 weeks. Love, Dad. Mammy and me are thinking of coming to Belfast. We'll see you tomorrow. Love, Dad. There is no Irish verb for love. But for Dad, with his new iPhone, the world is finally bigger than Irish limitations.
Thanks so much, and what a great way to round off this very special recording. And that is it for our 300th podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website, 10by9.com. 10 by 9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. And I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Our email is 10by9belfast@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who has helped keep 10 by 9 going over the years, including the lovely team at the Black Box, the best venue in Belfast. Thanks to all our 10 by 9 audiences, of course, going back to September 2011 when it all began. And of course, thanks to all our storytellers over the years, especially all those who've made it onto the podcast since 2017. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another deep dive into the 10 by 9 archive soon. But for now, bye-bye.